Yeah.
Hello, mother.
Wow, you're British to this today.
This today. I did just have some afternoon tea.
Okay.
Sorry.
We've discussed your accents before.
They're not good, I know.
No, they're okay. I mean,
the British one, I used to be able to do really fucking well.
And then?
I stopped going to England all the time.
Oh, you're so fancy. I stopped going to England every other week.
Hey, I stopped vacationing in England all the time. Wow. So.
Wowzers.
It was great. I miss my days in England. I would live there.
I'll bet. Except for it's raining, chilly. But you like that.
Except for every single time I've been out there, it's been like 70 plus degree weather. So I've really only ever experienced the rainy, terrible, shitty weather one night in the entire time I was there. And that that night that I was, that my girlfriends and I all went out to a bar and we were staying in a hostel, right? And I'm not the drunkest of all of us, but I was pretty crunk. I was pretty up there. We were at the Harry Potter, like, illusions bar kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And I was getting so irritated with one of the girls. I was like, I'm drinking a lot. Plus, I'm on vacation right now for college credit. I'm drinking a lot. And then we get back to the hostel, getting ready to go to bed. It's like fucking 3 a.m. And all of a sudden, our hostel's like getting ready to burn down. And I had to go find us a hotel room.
In the rain.
In the rain. Yeah, at 4 a.m.
Yeah.
I'm walking around fucking London with my eye mask on my head, going to go find a vacant hotel room for all of us, or vacancies, I should say, for all of us. Yeah. That was a fucking time to be alive.
Nice.
I told everyone, not everyone, I told these creepy guys on the tube, I was like, my name's Kylie, and that's Courtney, and that's Kim. Oh, jeez. Because they were being weird.
So you were weird back.
Yeah. So we were like, and that was funny because I don't think that they understood that we were giving the Kardashians names, but it's fine.
Right.
Lived.
Doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Lived. I was not butchered by the Ripper. What's his name?
Jack the Ripper.
Jack the Ripper. I don't know why I kept wanting to say Ed. In my brain, I was like, Ed the Ripper. Ed the Ripper didn't come from me then.
Wow. Ed the Ripper. I feel like that'd be something from here. From the United States.
Ed. Right? Ed the Ripper.
Good old Ed the Ripper.
Good old Ed the Ripper. All right, Mom, what's your disturbing fact?
Okay, so my disturbing fact is that, and I'm trying to figure out how to frame this.
Or I should say your disgusting fact.
Yeah, it's not disgusting this week.
Oh, thank God.
I could have, but I didn't. So I was trying to figure out how to frame this, but then I found more different facts, and so now it's become harder to frame it a different way.
Okay.
Because I was trying to keep you guessing on the edge of your seat until
I'm on the edge of my seat. You're not giving me any information. There's so many fucking possibilities.
So in 2009, I believe, the article is from 2009, but I don't know if it occurred in 2009 because I was trying to find that. But anyway, a Russian man.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about the bird plague.
No, a Russian man goes into a hospital and he is coughing up blood and having chest pain. And he's been having severe chest pain.
You said this wasn't disgusting.
Sorry. Well, it's not that bad.
Blood.
So anyway, so he goes into the hospital. It's a Russian guy. He's 28 years old, goes into the hospital. He is coughing up blood. He's been having chest pain for a while. So they do a chest x-ray and they see what looks like to be cancer. So they decide that the best option is to do surgery. And obviously, like, all this isn't happening. Like, they don't go, oh, we're going to surgery right now. But anyway, so, you know, they're taking x-rays, they're making their diagnosis. It's in his lung. So they decided that they're not going to, like, do chemo or radiation or anything like that. They're going to resect the lung because the lung has lobes. And so they could take out just a piece of the lung, right?
Right.
So they get in there to take out that piece of the lung, and it was not a tumor. It was not cancer. It was about a 2-inch fir tree.
I've heard this before. I didn't know if that's where you were going with that.
Growing in his lung.
But I've also heard this be debunked.
I was looking for it to be debunked, but I could only find one place where it was debunked. And all the other places are saying that it's true because there's another case, a man in Massachusetts who was battling COPD, bronchitis, like, I don't know, hang on.
Something with his lungs.
Yeah, let me see. Blah, 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 blah. Emphysema.
Emphysema. Okay.
Yeah. So he had been battling emphysema, and this is in the States. This is in Massachusetts. He had been battling emphysema for months, and all of a sudden he got really super bad. His lung collapsed. And so he ended up going to the ER and they took x-rays because why is his lung collapsed? He has
emphysema.
Yeah.
Emphysema.
Emphysema. Emphysema.
Well, why are we the same person?
I don't know. It's very frightening.
Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's also great and wonderful because I'm like, hey, can I borrow that? And you're like, only if you give it back. I'm like, well, maybe.
5 years later, can I have that back, please?
Yeah, we just had a conversation about that the other day.
Yeah.
You said you like, you said you were okay with borrowing things with me from, that we were okay borrowing things from each other because you could get them back. I was like, well, maybe. Your giggle. Okay, sorry, continue.
Sorry. This guy, he ends up in the hospital.
Getting x-rays, yeah.
Yeah, and they see something, so they do surgery, and it was a pea that was sprouting in his lungs.
I guess it makes sense, though, right? Because it's like oxygenated.
It's damp, it's dark, it's oxygenated.
Yeah.
So it does make sense. And it said that they said, the doctor said that he must have like swallowed it wrong, you know, and it went down his trachea instead of his esophagus. And then it just went into his lungs. And like normally, so the reason that they're, the debunking thing is because, you know, there's cilia in your lungs that move everything. And like if you get something in your lungs, like say you swallow water wrong or you
hack it up.
Yeah, you clear, your lungs will clear it. But these things were not cleared by the lungs. So the guy with the spruce tree, they're speculating.
A fir tree.
They're speculating that he probably inhaled a seed. And that's what happened to that. So anyway, but
that
like
makes
I
me
said,
really uncomfortable.
Well, like I said, only one article could I find that they were like, oh, no, it's bullshit, blah, blah, blah. It can't happen. But all the other things were no, it can happen.
Scientifically, it makes sense, right? Like you said, it's damp, it's dark, it's an oxygenated environment.
Yeah.
Like it kind of seems like a mecca for those kinds of things to actually thrive and grow. I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often or that we know about.
Exactly. Well, and I remember this kid that I used to babysit for, he was having all kinds of sinus problems and stuff.
You have other kids in your life besides me?
I was like so young when I babysat because, you know, it's not my thing. But anyway,
you had other kids in your life?
He was having sinus issues and they finally took him to the doctor. And I mean, I think they had been taking him to the doctor, but they ended up pulling a pea or a bean out of his nose. That it sprouted.
Oh, fuck
into
that.
Into his sinus cavities.
Oh, my God. How mm-hmm. scary.
Yeah. And that was a real incident that I'm personally aware of.
Yeah.
Anyway, this Mr. Svendon that this happened to in Massachusetts, this is a direct quote from him. He said, whether this would have gone full term, I'd be working for the Jolly Green Giant. I don't know. I think the thing that finally dawned on me is that, thank God, this wasn't cancer.
Yeah.
And one of the first meals that he had in the hospital after his surgery, he had peas and he laughed to himself and he ate them.
I would still eat peas. I love peas.
I love peas.
I don't know if I particularly enjoy fir seeds, but...
Well, he inhaled it. So anyway, yeah, that's it. That's kind of disturbing. And
it is terribly disturbing.
But like I said, I could only find one place where
I'm wondering the long-term effects of this. Because, like, Dad, he got poked in the chest, right, with a pine needle and got cancer. Got environmental cancer.
A Russian olive thorn.
Yeah. He got environmental cancer.
Yeah. Well, there's another...
And so I'm wondering what, like, the long-term effects of this are.
I guess
they haven't said... There's been no updates in the cases.
There has not been any updates in the cases. Well, and then there was another one where a lady got stabbed with the same thing as your dad, kind of. And it was just like a 5-inch splinter that they had to pull out. But that was when I was going down the rabbit hole of trying to like figure out whether it was true or not. And so then all these stories about people getting punctured in the chest and having something in their lungs. But these were the only two that I could find that were inhaled, an inhalation of something that grew inside the lungs. And only the one article said, no, it's bullshit.
Okay. Well, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It totally makes sense, scientifically, that could happen.
It does. So anyway, that's my disturbing fact.
I like it. I wonder what's happened inside my lungs.
I don't know.
How many things have I swallowed wrong in my lifetime? A billion.
Right. Well, and also it's known that mold spores can grow in your lungs.
Yeah.
That's why people that have black mold in their houses and stuff can die because the spores start growing inside their lungs.
That's so scary.
It's so scary.
Why can't
a tree grow or a pea?
Yeah, a tree or a pea.
Mm-hmm.
Either
Ooh,
one.
That rhymes.
A tree or a pea.
Either way, man.
So what do you got for me today, sweet child of mine?
Yeah, the only child in your life.
Yes.
It better be anyway. That's when you're talking about this other kid. I'm like, who?
Who?
Who's this other child?
Yeah, it was...
I'm the only child in your life.
It was my life, BD, before Daphne.
Yeah, we don't talk about that life.
There's BD and AD, and now I have ADHD.
What does that stand for?
After Daphne, holy damn.
Holy damn. I like it. After Daphne, holy damn is the phase we're in right now. The stay-at-home daughter phase.
I love it.
Well, somebody's got to do it.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have the murder.
I offered to take you to work with me and train you how to do my job so you could do my job and I could stay home.
Yeah, but then you'd have to do my master's degree.
Yeah, probably not the best plan if you want to pass.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking.
Okay, gotcha.
And I have flying colors, so.
Yes, your colors are flying.
My colors are flying high in the sky. Drinking some fine wine.
Okay.
I know you hate wine. Okay, this is the murder of... Fuck. I'm like, I know how to say this. Now I'm like, no, I don't know how to say this. Of Kitty Genovese.
So the Genovese crime family. And spoiler alert, you literally said the murder of.
Yes.
So she gets murdered.
Okay. But no, not related. Not the same family.
Oh, okay.
And the craziness. Because there'd
be some serious fucking retaliation if it was the Genovese crime family. Kitty.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'll bet there's a Kitty in the Genovese crime family.
I'm sure there is somewhere along the lines. Mm-hmm. Somewhere around all the generations. There had to have been, right?
Yeah.
It's a pretty common name, nickname.
Yeah.
And about like the craziness that happened in the press around this case is why like this is a pretty infamous case.
Okay. Do tell. I'm on pins and needles. Inhaling peas and
fur seeds
to see what happens.
So Catherine Susan Kitty Genovese, she was born in Brooklyn, New York on July 7th, 1935. She was the oldest of five siblings to her parents, Vincent and Rachel, and they were an Italian-American family, if you didn't already gather by the last name.
Got it.
And in New York. Her brother recalls this time he was eating spaghetti and didn't finish it, so she dumped it on his head.
Oh, I like it. I mean, it's like kind of a mess. It's
fiery.
Yeah, it sounds like a mess, but...
So she was always known as talkative and energetic, and she was very popular in school. She graduated from the Prospect Heights All-Girls High School in 1953, okay. And she was voted as class cut up her senior year.
So she's funny.
Yes. I didn't know what that meant, so I looked it up. It's like the class clown. And she was also described as being a good student. After her graduation in 1953, her mother, Rachel, had witnessed a murder on the streets, which prompted the family to move to New Canaan, Connecticut. New Canaan.
I don't know, but I don't like witnessing a murder on the street.
Yeah, I don't like
that
it either.
That seems bad.
But Kitty, she decided to stay in New York. She stayed in the city with her grandparents to prepare for her upcoming marriage to Rocco Fazolare.
I don't know.
Rocco. Doesn't really matter because they were married October 31st, 1954, Halloween. It was soon and old.
So she's like 18, 19?
Yeah. It was soon and old. And then she's 19 because, she was born in 1935. So she's 19.
Okay.
And then they were divorced in 1956. But they were annulled like pretty quickly after they got married.
Okay. Yeah. Weird. An 18, 19-year-old getting married.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, it was a very short-lived time in her life, obviously.
Obviously. So, sometimes it works out, though, but clearly not this time.
Yeah, sometimes it does, but not this time. This was not the instance where it worked out.
This was not the time.
And most of the time, I've heard it doesn't work out, but that's just me being cynical of love. She worked as a secretary for an insurance company, and in the late 1950s, she moved into her own apartment in Brooklyn, and she began working as a bartender after she found, like, her work as a secretary was kind of boring and unappealing to her.
But isn't that kind of risque? In the 50s for a woman to be a bartender?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. In August of 1961, she was arrested for bookmaking.
Ooh.
She and her friend, Dee Guarnieri. I don't know. Guarnieri. Yeah,
that's it, for sure.
Had been taking bets on horse races from bar patrons.
I like it.
And they were fined $50, and she lost her job.
Oh, that sucks.
And I think I made two notes of this in here, so I guess I'll just say it now. The, like, most popular picture, if you Google her, is her photo of her being booked, her mugshot.
Aw, sad.
It's okay. It's a cute picture.
Oh, good. I'm glad she takes a nice mugshot.
Kitty was headstrong and hardworking. She soon found a job at Eve's 11th Hour Bar in Hollis, Queens. She eventually became the bar manager, filling in for the absentee owner.
That's cool.
She was extremely reliable and had a very positive attitude, which was reflected in her salary.
Nice.
She made about $750 a month, which was about $6,800 in today's money.
Wow.
Yeah. And she was saving this.
So she was rolling.
Yeah. She wanted to, her like lifelong goal, her dream was to own her own Italian restaurant.
Or so balling.
She's balling. She's hustling.
Yeah.
She's hustling. No cap. she wanted to open up her own Italian restaurant. So she's saving like towards this goal of hers.
Mm-hmm.
And on March 13th, 1963, she met Mary Ann Zylonko at Swing Rendezvous, which was an underground lesbian bar in Greenwich Village.
Okay. So is that why her marriage didn't work out?
Because she was
a lesbian?
Because she was in the closet. That's what I was going to say, because she was in the closet.
Mm-hmm. Or she just didn't know.
Well, I didn't actually include this part in here. I did include what Mary had to say later about it, that she like really loved her, but she said that she felt like Kitty was like not totally comfortable with her sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's why it didn't work out. In this documentary, which I bring up several times, but I like talk about it more at the end of my notes down at the bottom,
mm-hmm.
just given the nature of like the documentary, it fits better at the bottom of at the end of what we're going to be talking about.
Gotcha.
Towards like the all the press stuff. But her brother tried to talk to the ex-husband, to Rocco,
mm-hmm.
and he was like, you know, I respected Kitty and all that. He's like, but I would respect if my life would remain private.
Gotcha.
So we don't really know. He said his life with Kitty will always be a mystery, is basically what he said.
Alrighty then. The intrigue.
So, yeah, I know, right? That makes us want to know more.
I think I know this story, though, now that you're... But that's okay, because okay. I don't know the deets.
Okay, it's pretty fucking crazy.
Well, then maybe I don't, because I don't remember it being crazy. I just remember it being random. But anyway, we'll keep going, so, and I'll tell you.
Mary and Kitty, they, like, fell pretty fast for each other. They decided to move in together. They found an apartment on the second floor of a two-story building called The Tudor, next to the Long Island Railroad in Kew's Gardens in Queens.
Mm-hmm.
On March 13th, so this is, like, a year after they met, right?
Mm-hmm.
1964, Kitty was returning home from work around 2:30 a.m.
I am.
2:30 a.m. when she was approached by a man with a knife. So she ran towards her apartment building's front door, which I'm going to post pictures of this map. Because it makes a lot of sense.
Okay, Dora.
Can you say map? She ran towards her apartment's front door, but the man grabbed her and stabbed her. And she started screaming, you know, I'm being stabbed. Help me, help me. I'm screaming at the top of her lungs.
Aw, poor Kitty.
I know. A neighbor in the Mowbray apartment complex, which was like right across Austin Street,
mm-hmm.
from them, from her apartment complex.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, setting it up in your brains. The Mowbray is across the street from the Tudor,
mm-hmm.
and like tucked behind, but like in, there's like a parking lot, but in the same area is that train station.
Okay.
Of the Tudor. So the Tudor is like next to this train station, right? And across from the Mowbray.
Okay.
A neighbor, his name was Robert Moser. He was in apartment 715. He screamed out after he heard Kitty screaming and yelled out his window to leave the girl alone, which made the attacker flee.
Good.
So Kitty then crawled towards the backside of her apartment building, which is like towards the railroad mm-hmm. station, towards the train station.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, she's like seriously injured.
So yeah, she's been like stabbed.
Yeah. So she's, you know, like trying to make her way there. And now she's out of view of any possible witnesses because she's around the back, like towards the entrance of her own apartment.
Okay.
So she was laying near the bottom of the stairs, which belonged to neighbor Carl Ross's apartment. It's like how you get up to his apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 minutes later, her attacker came back.
Oh, shit.
And in that 10 minutes, when he had fled to his car, he realized that no one was going to intervene. So after a few minutes of sitting there, he changed from like his like brimmed hat, where it was really hard to make out his face, into a different hat.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he got back to her, he stabbed her, he raped her, and he stole $49 from her.
What a fucker. Why I don't understand why nobody comes to her rescue. I mean, I realize that probably on the backside, maybe she couldn't say anything or do anything. But the guy that yelled out the window in the first place, that's like, leave the girl alone. And he can hear her screaming, I'm being stabbed. Why doesn't that guy go out and check to see if she's okay?
We're going to get into a lot of this.
Because it's New York and he doesn't want to get involved.
Save your bugging questions, okay?
Okay.
Save those regarding...
Save my judgment as I sit here with my arms crossed, being all irritated.
Save your judgments. So she was found by a neighbor. I don't know if it's Sophie or Sophia. One or the other. She was referred to as actually both in the documentary.
Okay.
Like, all the sources of her said Sophie. Mm-hmm. But Bill, who's Kitty's brother, who made the documentary, which, again, we're going to dive into, called her Sophia.
Okay.
So I guess we'll call her Sophia for the sake of consistency and what he called her.
We could call her Soph.
Yeah, we could call her Soph. Sophia Farrar, Soph. She found her on the bottom of the stairs, which again led to Carl's apartment about 30 minutes after like it all happened. I think it was 30 minutes after the initial attack on the front side of the building or 30 minutes after he'd found her again. Mm-hmm. Regardless, she screamed at the top of her lungs for someone to call the police, and they had arrived several minutes later. However, it was too late for Kitty, and she died on her way to the general hospital in the ambulance.
That's so sad.
It's so fucking sad.
I don't like it.
So the records of the calls to the police are unclear, with multiple neighbors claiming to have called the police or called friends who called the police. And yeah, so that's kind of what's happening.
So people are saying they did call the police?
People are saying that they did call the police.
And no police came until that one, till Soph called.
Soph didn't call herself, but she screamed for someone to call.
Right. Okay.
And then they called.
Okay.
So at around 4 a.m.-ish is about the time that she was knew who she was. Mm-hmm. The police arrived to Kitty and Mary's apartment.
Mary?
Marianne. Mm-hmm. The girlfriend.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was Marianne.
Marianne. I don't know. They referred to her as both as well.
Okay. But, gotcha. Damn, this is confusing.
She's the same person, though. To inform Marianne of Kitty's attack, which led to her death.
That's so sad.
And around 7 a.m., Detective Mitchell Sang arrived to question Marianne, who was there with the neighbor Carl, right? The one who she was at the bottom of his stairs. Kitty was at the bottom of his stairs, who was consoling her with booze. Oh, and also, mind you, the way that this apartment's set up, Sophia talked about this later. She like had like a brief little part in the documentary, but the way that she found her was an inward opening door, and so she was at the bottom of these stairs, right, which led to this guy's apartment. Mm-hmm. But it's an inward door, so she's at the bottom of these stairs and her head is like, her like feet are basically on the stairs and her head is down by the door. Mm-hmm. So when Sophia went to like open the door, she hit her.
Oh
yeah,
add insult to injury,
right? Well, I mean, she didn't know she was like right there,
right? Gotcha.
Because it's an inward opening door.
Yeah.
So Detective Sang thought that Carl being there while questioning Marianne was intrusive. So he arrested Carl for disorderly conduct.
Are you kidding?
Nope.
Well,
pretty fucking wild, right?
Did Carl put a big old fight?
I think he was just drunk.
Oh, yeah, because they were drinking to console themselves or to deal with what had just happened.
Yeah. So he also knew that Kitty's body was found at the base of Carl's apartment. And at some point later in the day, homicide detectives John Carroll and Jerry Burns arrived to question Marianne. And this questioning like turned very inappropriate, you know, grilling her about their sex life and other just very private matters.
Right. None of your business, fucker.
And this lasted for about 6 hours.
Just the facts.
Yep. Just the facts. What the fuck happened? The police questioning of neighbors led to the preoccupation with the gay lifestyle. So they were like really caught up in this gay lifestyle, the police were.
Yeah.
Which then turned Marianne into being a suspect.
Oh, please.
Right.
Well, I mean, I guess to be fair, I think the person that they always look at is going to be the partner, spouse, whatever. But if the person in the apartment across the street said that it was a guy.
Yeah.
Obviously, Marianne is not a guy.
So I don't know who all knows, like, what exactly is going on in their relationship, because the brother said it wasn't until years later that he found out that they were actually in a relationship. He was just thought that they were roommates.
Yeah. And there's that.
Yeah.
So she wasn't completely comfortable with her sexuality.
Yep.
So she was like, hey, this is my roommate.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't understand the nature of the relationship. So later on that week, March 19th, police got a call about a suspected robbery. And when the police showed up, they found a TV in the trunk of the suspect's car. So he'd, like, robbed a house.
Okay.
And the suspect was Winston Mosley, who was arrested and taken to the station and confessed to stealing appliances on like dozens of occasions.
Like refrigerators?
Yeah, I guess. It just said appliances.
Okay.
So Winston Mosley was 29 years old, married, and had two sons. He was from Ozone Park, Queens, and worked at the Remington Rand as a tab operator, preparing the punch cards to use at the time mainly for data input for computers.
Okay, but obviously he's not making good money if he's stealing.
Right, if he's trying to be a career criminal.
Yeah.
But he had no record also, so he's getting away with it.
But I'm like, so to this point, he was good at it.
So he drove a white Corvair. And
a Chevy Corvair,
I guess.
Yes.
Are those cars out of style? I've never heard of that.
I don't know. I don't even know what it looks like.
They're probably out of style.
Yeah, I think they're not now. I mean, I think they don't exist now.
That's what I'm saying. Out of style. Yes. Out of the life.
Yes.
Out of the life.
Not in our lives.
Not in our lives. Yes. Detective John Tartaglia. Remembered witnesses to Kitty's murder reporting seeing a white car. And when this was brought to Winston's attention, you know, he just played coy, didn't know anything, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Then Detective Tartaglia. I don't know how you say it.
I like it the way that you're saying it.
Called in Detectives John Carroll and Mitchell Sang. And they noticed scabs on Winston's hands, accused him of killing Kitty. And he replied that, yeah, I did it, and confirmed information that only the killer would know.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's like, yeah, sure, fine, whatever, you got me.
Does he hate his life that much that he's willing to confess to a murder?
Right? Oh, my gosh.
Unless he actually did do it. But even still.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Fucked up.
That's weird. Bizarre.
So Winston stated that he saw Kitty at a traffic light, and while he was sitting in his parked car, and then he followed her home. When he was driving away from Kew's Gardens after the murder, he had crossed paths with a driver who had fallen asleep at a red light, which he approached the car. He held his knife like behind his back and walked up to this driver and then just woke him up and sent him on his way. So,
okay. Sorry, I'm shaking my head.
So he was asked, like, why didn't you kill this guy? Obviously, you know, he's giving like the details and all like the records of the events that took place. And he's like, yeah, I didn't want to kill him.
Alrighty then.
Yeah.
I just wasn't feeling it.
Okay. So, you know, obviously he's basically victim hunting, but he didn't give any motive for the attack on Kitty. Later interrogations led to finding that he was guilty of multiple rapes and two other murders.
Oh, geez.
So there's Annie Mae Johnson. She was discussed in the documentary I watched. And then there was Barbara Kralik, and she's been listed by a few sources and the DA of Queens. So I thought I'd like mention her, but she wasn't like talked about in the documentary. And I don't know if it was, I mean, we'll dive into her, but I don't know if it was because she was 15 and maybe like her family didn't want her mentioned in the documentary.
Makes sense.
But Annie Mae Johnson was a 24-year-old housewife and mother in South Ozone Park. And he killed her just 2 weeks before he killed Kitty.
Aww.
So according to Winston, he approached her as she was getting out of her car at night at home. She was shot in the stomach with a 22 caliber rifle.
So he shoots.
Sometimes. I mean, stabs and whatever.
Well, because, you know, it
seems whatever he can get his fucking hands on, basically, however he can do damage.
Because isn't that weird when killers change their method?
Yeah, it is weird.
Okay.
But, I mean, there was never, like, any mention as to why, like, he changed his method.
Okay. Well, maybe a gun was too loud.
Maybe for kitties. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, he did this, like, right outside of her home. Mm-hmm. And he didn't say if he had a silencer on it or not.
Okay.
And then he rolled her after he shot her in the stomach into her own home and raped her while her family was upstairs.
Fuck.
And she was still breathing when he was about ready to leave. So he decided to crumble up a bunch of newspapers and lit the house on fire. I think her whole family made it out and lived, but she did not.
That's horrible.
Yeah, he's a piece of shit. And this is a quote from the source with the interview that they did with the Queens District Attorney, Frank O'Connor.
Mm-hmm.
Says Mosley insisted that he shot the victim several times. I shot her in the stomach. I reloaded and I shot her again in the stomach, he told cops. But the autopsy on Johnson had listed the cause of death as puncture wounds from a sharp object such as a screwdriver or a file. Based on Mosley's confession, the body was exhumed from a cemetery in Monk's Corner, South Carolina. A second autopsy was performed. Using x-ray equipment borrowed from the South Carolina Medical College in Charleston, the coroner found 6 bullets inside Johnson's body. 4 of these bullets were recovered. The findings of these bullets add a lot of credence to Winston Mosley's other statements.
Okay.
And that's direct from Frank O'Connor.
Well, and did they find a gun?
I don't know. Okay. There's not much out there about these two cases, unfortunately.
That sucks. I hate that.
There's more out there about Kitty.
Right.
But I wanted to mention these because they were listed and talked about like multiple times.
I had heard that about that murder, Kitty, but I didn't hear any of this other stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty fucking insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like pretty wild. I mean, and it's wild, like, from my interest as a person who's learned a lot about journalism and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
From my own background perspectives, this is also really interesting to me. But again, we're going to dive into that part of why it's interesting to me and, like, why this kind of caused a circus and still is a circus.
Okay.
Why this whole case. Barbara Kralik was 15 years old when she was murdered in her parents' Springfield Gardens home the previous July, is what it said.
Okay.
And this is a quote, again, from the interview with the Queen's district attorney, Frank O'Connor.
So was Barbara the first victim then?
I guess. Okay. Yes, she had to have been. Or first known. I mean, he's only confessed to three, though.
Okay. Well, that's enough.
Yeah, only.
Right.
In the
underachiever.
Underachiever, yeah, you. Fucked up. In the murder of 15-year-old Barbara Kralik, there was blood.
Although, sorry to interrupt, doesn't that qualify him as a serial killer?
I think it does, yeah. I think it does qualify him to be a serial killer.
We don't like him. We didn't like him anyway, but.
We didn't like him ever. After he started stealing shit.
Yeah.
It's like the same reason why we hate Jess on Gilmore Girls.
Yeah.
Rory, you may love him.
Don't get me started on that fucker.
Yeah, we're on season, what, 4?
Mm-hmm.
And he just came back. Ugh. My mom's like fucking pissed off and irritated the whole episode. Even though it's kind of like sweet with Liz, his mom, Jess, or Luke's sister, saying that Luke's her hero and all these things. And my mom's like, but she fucking birthed Jess, so fuck this bitch. Okay, I'm going to read you this quote now.
Okay. Sorry.
In the murder of 15-year-old Barbara Kralik, there was blood evidence available. No test yet existed that can compare bodily fluids for conclusive DNA identification. Mosley, however, was able to supply details that confirmed the existing evidence. Cops were satisfied they had the right man. Even his own court-appointed attorney, Sidney G. Sparrow, believed Mosley. And this is a quote from him. I'm convinced Mosley did all three of these killings, he told reporters after he met with his client for 3 hours in the Kings County psych ward. There are too many things he knew that
those
only
my socks.
Yes. There are too many things he knew that only the killer could know, he added. Now you're making me laugh through this quote.
Sorry.
What the fuck, Mom? Yes, I like these socks, so I took them.
Sorry, and we were talking about borrowing each other's stuff, so my bad. I just was surprised when I saw your foot, your shoeless foot with my sock on it.
Well, I have to take off my shoes, otherwise then I kick and get all jittery. I get all fidgety. Okay, so that was that one quote.
Can you start it again? I'm sorry, because I was distracted by you wearing my socks.
Okay, here's a quote from a source with an interview with the Queen's District Attorney, Frank O'Connor. In the murder of 15-year-old Barbara Kralik.
Was your elbow popping?
It was my elbow popping.
Sorry, okay.
Restarting one last time. Take 4, 3, 4.
2, 1.
Quote from a source with an interview with the Queen's District Attorney, Frank O'Connor. In the murder of 15-year-old Barbara Kralik, there was blood evidence available. No test yet existed that can compare bodily fluids for conclusive DNA identification. Mosley, however, was able to supply details that confirmed the existing evidence. Cops were satisfied they had the right man. Even his court-appointed attorney, Sidney G. Sparrow, believed Mosley. And this is a quote from him. I'm convinced that Mosley did all three of these killings, he told reporters after he met with his client for 3 hours in Kings County psych ward. There are too many things he knew that only the killer could know, he added. And that's the end of that whole quote.
So why did he end up in a psych ward?
Probably for evaluation.
Okay.
Which this next quote is kind of like an insight to.
Okay.
So this is from the same source. But there was more. Mosley confessed to other attacks during the nighttime expeditions, which he would roam the streets searching for victims at random. He said he raped many women, frequently robbing them in the process. Mosley admitted to dozens of burglaries, including the one for which he was arrested when he was caught stealing a television. But it was the sexual assaults that had the detectives interested, particularly the failed attempts of rape, which several women reported. Mosley, it seems, esteemed preferred sex with the dead. Dr. Oscar Diamond, a psychiatrist from the Manhattan State Hospital, performed a pretrial psychiatric examination of Mosley. He told me he got no thrill with the live women he raped, he later told the court.
Well, I guess that's why he's in a psychiatric institution.
See, if you would just let me continue sometimes, I'm like, I got the answers coming for you.
Well, welcome to my world.
Sorry.
It's okay. Inquiring minds wanted to know. Thank you for taking us there.
Yes, absolutely. So, yeah, this guy's just fucked all around.
Yeah.
So he was sentenced to death. The jury found him totally guilty on June 15th, 1964. But it was later reduced to a life sentence in 1967.
I was going
to
say, if somebody's insane, how can they, or...
I don't think they ruled him as insane, though. I think they're probably just like, this guy's fucking weird.
Yeah. Like, he has a mental disorder.
Yeah, but there was no, like, him, like, blacking out during these events.
Right. But having sex with dead people seems like a mental disorder.
Yeah.
Or preferring that to a live person.
Right. Fucking weird.
Yeah, so weird.
I already told you that they moved it to a life sentence in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
He later claimed that Kitty was executed by a mobster and that he was only the getaway driver. And I think this came from the documentary, because I saw it in the documentary, but I saw it on a source as well.
Okay.
But this was in a letter to Kitty's brother who did the documentary. He was trying to speak with him. Bill was trying to speak with Winston.
Mm-hmm.
And he wouldn't see him. But he wrote a letter back to him and was like, changed his story. But then in the past was also like, said like every detail that you could want to know. And then was also like, but I actually don't remember anything. So, you know, he's just kind of all over the place.
Yeah, he's one of those.
He's one of those. Can't get his story straight.
Right.
And then this was also in the interview. Bill is Kitty's brother. Mm-hmm. Bill did an interview with his son, was one of his two sons. Who's now a reverend, I think he was, or a pastor.
Wow.
Yeah, right. And he said this in the interview, that his son believes that he attacked Kitty because she was yelling racial slurs at him.
Is he black?
He's black.
Okay.
Yeah. Fucked up, right?
Yeah, I feel like...
That's just fucking insult to injury of her memory. And it's pretty clear and obvious that... And just through everything that, you know, she was like an ally.
Yeah, it seems like... Given her situation, that she would be a tolerant person.
Yeah.
And everybody said she was funny and fun, and like nobody said she was a racist.
Yeah. There's nothing about that. So I think that's just fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
And then the son also in the documentary was like, but we don't really talk about those kinds of things. All he talks about is how he's reformed. And then he went on to like get a sociology degree while he was in prison, and then wrote an editorial for the New York Times or Post or something like that, for an article, for a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, for a newspaper. And then was like, I'm a reformed man. And then this whole thing, the son and Bill were like, the son basically said to him was like, do you think if that, like, my dad deserves to be paroled? Like, forgiveness is like... You're looking for forgiveness here by like doing this documentary, blah, 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 blah. Don't you think my dad deserves to be paroled? Like, he's a reformed man. And he's like, you know, as much hardship as like this cost your family, in which he also addressed like the crime family, the Genovese crime family.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, the son was like, yeah, everyone told me not to come to this interview, that I wasn't going to make it out alive. And he was like, I'm not a part of that family. Like, that is not my family.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he was like talking about how like in school, him and his brother were like at the fucking just forefront of bullying because their dad was a killer and all this stuff. And it's like, Bill was like, I'm sorry that happened to you. He's like, you know, that wasn't your fault. He's like, I place no blame on you. Were seven at the time when mm-hmm. your dad was arrested and convicted.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, these are things your dad did.
Right. The sins of the father.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, it sucks. That's what we always say, that it sucks for everybody.
It like, sucks for everyone.
Yeah, like all the families that it affects.
I mean, the only person who's not a victim is the perpetrator in all of it.
Right.
In all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Friends, family of the killer, the friends, the family of the victim. Everyone is a victim.
Yep. Exactly.
So in 1968, he escaped from prison.
Holy shit.
And terrorized Buffalo, New York. He broke into houses and he raped a woman at gunpoint. And then he took in hostages. And then the FBI like closed in on him. And the leader of the FBI at the time, like the New York division or the Buffalo division. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he like did an interview also on this documentary and was like, I sat down with him. He's like, he had the gun pointed at me. We were in chairs like across from each other. He's like, and I also had a gun in my pocket pointed at him. He's like, and I would have had a clean shot at him. And Bill was like, you weren't afraid to talk to him. He's like, I was actually so surprised that evil came in such a small package.
Well,
that, and he's like, I promised him, he's like, that we would be fair to him if he would let the hostages go and go back into custody. He's like, and he did that. And then that's when they said that, like, after his prison break, that he was, like, a reformed man.
Okay, so after the prison break. Because I'm like, that doesn't sound like reform.
Yeah, sorry, it was after that. But I had just, like, jumped the gun in telling you all this that I didn't have in my notes that I've just absorbed through the documentary.
Okay, because I'm like, I'm like, he's reformed, except for the part where he
isn't.
Escaped. And yeah, except for the part where he isn't.
So he died in jail on March 28th of 2016. At 81 years old.
Okay.
So the whole thing that I keep referring to, the whole press thing, all of this, it came from this case, which you may have heard of it, called the bystander effect or the Genovese syndrome.
I've never heard of the Genovese syndrome, but I've heard of the bystander effect.
Well, they use those two terms synonymously.
Gotcha.
But bystander effect is more common. So let's talk about the bystander effect. Psychologist Bib Latton and John Darley made their career studying the bystander effect after this whole thing happened and have shown in clinical experiments that witnesses are less likely to help the victim of a crime if there are other witnesses. The more witnesses, the less likely any one person will intervene.
That sounds,
so that's the bystander effect.
Sounds which reasonable, though.
I feel like we all have heard of the bystander effect.
Right, because you're like, well, there are five other people here, so
somebody's going to do something.
Yeah, I'm not going to get involved.
Yeah, I don't need to do anything because somebody else is doing something.
Mm-hmm.
So the first article that came out about this case in the Long Island Press and the New York Times made no mention of witnesses. But then in the March 27th edition, right, this is, we're talking like the middle of March when this all happened on March 13th.
Mm-hmm.
So what, like the March 14th edition or whatever, sometime really closely after this came out.
Okay.
No mention of witnesses. And then the March 27th story, like, really fucking shook everyone because this is how it opened. For more than half an hour, 38 respectable, law-abiding citizens in Queens watched a killer stalk and stab a woman in three separate attacks in Kew's Gardens. Not one person telephoned the police during the assault.
38 people?
We're going to dive into this.
That's a lot.
It is a lot, but we're going to dive into this.
I can't believe nobody fucking called 911.
We're going to dive into this.
Okay.
So the report was prompted by a conversation between the Times editor, Abe M. Rosenthal, and the police commissioner at the time, Michael Murphy, which he made a claim. The commissioner made a claim that this was like the basis for this article. He was like, I think you need to like publish this story. Like there were so many witnesses and like nobody did shit about it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like they just let this girl die. Like there was huge like apathy, obviously.
Yeah.
So the newspaper followed it up the next day with an analysis speaking to several experts on the psychology of why people would choose not to get involved. Later in the year, Rosenthal, he adapted this information into a book called 38 Witnesses, The Kitty Genovese Case. And the New York Times coverage has been criticized for factual errors and accused contriving a social phenomenon for sensationalistic purposes.
Okay, well, that doesn't sound unreasonable.
It does not at all, right?
Yeah.
Show. So, I can't English today.
Oh, my God.
It's because I'm trying to speak too much Italian over here. Joseph DeMay Jr., a lawyer, historian, and a Kew Gardens resident, has argued that the residents of nearby buildings could have seen the attack or understood that Kitty's life was in danger, and more important, that people did intervene by either shouting at the attacker or calling the police, right? Like, mm-hmm. We know that that did happen. There was the one neighbor across the street in that apartment complex who opened the door and screamed.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, there were the people during the second attack who called. Anyway, continuing. So trial testimony established that that Winston Mosley attacked Kitty Genovese, not three times, but twice, right? We already knew that. We already discussed that.
Mm-hmm.
So they're publishing false things.
Yeah, because I was like, what? Did I miss something?
You didn't miss anything. Okay. That's why this is like controversial, the press part about all this.
Gotcha.
With a 10-minute hiatus in between. When the first attack happened on Austin Street, right, facing the other apartment complex, a shout from a window, we already talked about this, scared Winston Mosley away.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, a retired police officer recalls when he was a boy, he was like nearby, that he saw a kitty staggering down the Austin street and that Winston Mosley was fleeing in the opposite direction and that his father called the police because they heard the screaming too.
Mm-hmm.
And that others have also said that they called. But again, those police records are really fucking unclear.
Gotcha.
So we know that she went around the corner, right, and down the alley to the back of the building where her entrance was,
mm-hmm.
and that she was attacked again out of sight from the windows on Austin Street. And only two neighbors have been shown to behave at the time of the murder, whereas the Times claimed, like, 38 people were, like, there, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
One of those was Carl Ross. He was drunk that night. He actually heard the noises. He opened the door to look at what was going on, saw her getting like attacked and saw her getting stabbed, closed the door. He called his girlfriend and said, "What do I do?" She said, "Don't get involved."
Oh, geez.
And after it like continued, like the attack continuing over time,
mm-hmm.
he then climbed out of his window into a neighbor's apartment, which I believe was Sophia.
Mm-hmm.
And he called the police after hearing Sophia Farrar call, like screaming to call the police. That's when he called.
Okay.
And Carl's explanation said, "I didn't want to get involved," which like that became like the most famous thing about the bystander effect was like his recount of the events was that "I don't want to get involved."
Mm-hmm.
So the bystander effect basically all came from this case, right, is how they established it. So despite all that evidence, though, Bib Latan, the PhD guy who I talked about earlier who studies the bystander effect,
mm-hmm.
like I said, this was all inspired by these events, says that the trial witnesses could have revised their stories to make them seem more caring. He said they had a strong reason to sort their memories and say that they weren't such bad guys after all.
Well, of course.
Decades later, following the murder, a journalistic movement began to correct the misinformation that was perpetuated by the New York Times story. In 2004, a journalist, Jim Rosenberger, he wrote an article about the Times debunking the claims of the 1964 reportings. And then a 2007 article in the American Psychologist by Rachel Manning, Mark Levine, and Alan Collins further deflates the claims that there were 38 people on standby.
Okay. It seems like a lot.
It does seem like a lot. So in 2015, like I was saying, I keep referring to this documentary. That's when this came out.
Mm-hmm.
Kitty Genovese's youngest brother, Bill, he produced and narrated the documentary, which was called The Witness. It was really fucking sad to watch.
I'm sure.
Which lays out the case against the New York Times. So he not only did he like talk about the story, he like archived so many of the people involved and like went back in and like asked. And so many of them were like, "Oh, I did call the police." Or there was this one woman who was in the building and she was like, "I talked to the police." She's like, "But my mom didn't." She's like, "So maybe we were counted in those 38. She's like, "But my mom never talked to the police about it."
Mm-hmm.
She's like, "I talked to the police about it." So my mom shouldn't have been one of those 38 people.
Okay.
So anyway, it was really sad and heartfelt to watch this documentary. Bill was saying that Kitty, his sister, was like the only person who really understood him.
Aww.
Yeah, really sad. He met with the prosecutor in the case, which was Charles Scholar, and they did like a whole rundown of events. Like they went to the neighborhood. They stood outside the Tudor on Austin Street, looked up at the other apartment complex, looked behind them at the train station,
mm-hmm.
saw the spot that Kitty parked in every day, like just whole nine.
Ugh.
Yeah.
That's heart-wrenching.
So Charles claims that because of the view and proximity from the first attack, that many of the neighbors could hear and see out their windows what was going on, and that Joseph Sfink, mm-hmm. who was in the apartment complex across the street, he was the night elevator operator. This is a several-story high building across the street.
Yeah.
Said that he could physically see the entire attack taking place, and that instead of doing anything, Joseph went downstairs to his apartment and went to sleep.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Can't you just call and, like, choose to remain anonymous?
No, you can't remain anonymous, I don't think. Unless you're giving, like, details later down the line, I don't think you can remain anonymous.
I don't know. I don't like it. It just sucks.
And then Bill spoke with Sophia Farrar's son, Michael, who was 5 when he also heard the screams. And he said that his mom would have done it like all over again, like went and saved because they were actually friends.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that she basically just like died in her arms and Ugh. She like told her it was okay and that, you know, she could like let go. She's like consoling her. And Michael like also recounted like when you opened up that doorway for a long time, like there was blood and that his mom, like there were multiple handprints, like bloody handprints on the wall.
And that his mom, like, had to explain to him, like, those were my handprints, like, from holding her and trying to stand up, like, after they had her in the ambulance, after, like, they had put her, like, what is it, the gurney, on the gurney. Yeah, those were my handprints from standing up.
That's so sad.
Like, trying to get myself up. Yeah, and that, like, for a long time after that, that you could just, like, smell blood in that entryway.
Ugh, so sad.
It's horrible. So crazy. Sophia, who was holding her friend when she died, was left out of all of the newspaper coverage.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that makes it seem even less credible.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Because the one person who actually was there and did something isn't a part of the story.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Right. And that's, the brother was saying, like, all the family was saying that they didn't really know anything, like, any crazy details, like, any actual details about the case until 1995. When he was up for parole, probation, something like that, when he had a parole hearing, which was obviously shut down because he died in prison, right? But they didn't know, like, any of the details of this because they had lived forever thinking that 38 people just, like, watched their sister die.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really terrible, too, to think that 38 people didn't do it. Well, when you said that in the beginning, I gasped.
Yeah.
Because it's like, holy shit, that's a lot of fucking people.
The takeaway of this, the whole documentary, that, like, in regards to, like, the press aspect of it, was that there were not 38 eyewitnesses. There was maybe a dozen or so ear witnesses. And because the police records are not clear at all, the phone records, they don't really know.
Okay.
Yeah. And so Bill shared a lot of really great things about Kitty and spoke to a lot of people, including Marianne, who said that she really loved Kitty, and a lot of the bar regulars who said that Kitty was one of the boys. And, like, her brother never even knew why she was arrested until, like, he went and did these interviews, right, with these people and found out that she, like, had a gambling issue or a horse racing issue.
That she was a bookie?
That she was a bookie. And he, you know, it was just, it was sweet to watch that part of the documentary and him, like, actually learning so much about his sister, because they talked about in the documentary that, like, it was kind of like a stigma of the family. Not a stigma, that's the wrong word to use. They just didn't talk about it. They just did not talk about her, like, what would have been her nieces and nephews. We're talking about, like, they had learned about her in psychology class, in, like, sociology classes.
In the bystander effect?
In the bystander effect.
Oh, wow, that's crazy.
But didn't know that that was their aunt until later.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Isn't that wild? But she's credited as one of the factors that pushed for the 911 system to go into place.
I did know that.
Yeah. So,
because, yeah, there was no 911, but you could call the police.
Yeah, you could call the police, but there wasn't a 911.
Right.
So that's the case. Do you have any other lingering questions for me?
I don't, because you answered everything. It's just, I don't, it's just terrible.
It's all horrible.
Yeah, it's terrible. And I don't know. I don't like him saying that, that the reason he did it was because she was yelling racial slurs. Like, obviously, the reason he did it is because that's what he does. Because
he's a fuckface. Because there were
two more victims prior to her.
Yeah, for literally no reason at all. Not that there's never a reason to kill anyone.
No. But they were there, and that's what he did.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a fuckface.
Yeah, he's a
fuckface. This guy sucks.
Yeah.
Well, this guy's dead super now, sucks. So. Yeah.
Yep. He's along with the other ones that belong in hell.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
Special place for them.
Yes, there is.
All right, well, yeah, that's it. That's all I got.
Okay. Well, thank you.
It was a really good documentary.
And thanks for doing this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, you know.
Kind of last minute. Then we needed a true crime case.
Yeah.
Neither of us were working on true crime things. And we're like, we need a true crime case because we haven't done a true crime case in a hot minute.
Yeah.
A true crime craze.
A craze. And I'm trying to, but I'm so freaking busy at work right now. Ugh. I come home and I'm just fried.
Well, yeah, that's all I got.
All right.
Do you have any last-minute comments, questions, concerns regarding this?
No, other than thank you.
Well, you can...
That's not a comment or a concern, but Daphne,
it is a comment.
Oh, it's a comment.
It's not a question or a concern.
See, I'm tired. I'm like, I don't even know what a comment is.
I don't even know what a comment is. All right. Well, you can follow us on the gram at That's Disturbing Podcast, or send us a DM there, too, if you want to, like, give us any cool cases that you want us to work on. We do have a case request, finally.
Finally! Well, we've had several.
Yeah.
Ish.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Case-ish.
Yeah, case-ish.
Which we need to get Patty on.
Yes. Well, and the one that we just got We're going to get that one going. I don't know. I'm working on two, like I always do. I'm so dumb, especially because I have so much other stuff going on. I don't know. I have After Daphne.
Holy damn.
Holy damn.
After Daphne, holy damn life happening.
Yeah.
You can send us a Gmail. That's disturbingpodcast@gmail.com. Yeah, that's all we got. There's no more website. Website's gone. Website's been gone.
Yeah.
Kiss the website's butt goodbye.
Aw. But you kept the domain name.
I did keep the domain. It's still us.
Yeah. It's still us.
It's still us. We're still disturbed.
Yes, we are. All right. Well, thanks, Daph. Much appreciated.
Yeah, this was a sad one. But yeah. The documentary was really good. I think it's on Peacock, but it's on YouTube also.
Okay.
Called The Witness.
The Witness.
The Witness is great. You guys should watch it. Okay, that's all. Bye-bye.